Well, good evening. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, and supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And of course, we always welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being. We have with us David Bay. And we're going to, from Cutting Edge Ministries, we're going to be talking a little bit about, a couple of things. First of all, a new movie that's out called Minority Report. And David has written a fascinating treatise on this. Of course, the movie is set sometime in the future, 2057. It's a futuristic concept of what life will be like. But you see, we are moving into a very strange future. We are moving here in America into a surveillance society in the name of course, fighting the wicked terrorists, but people do not understand, unless they perhaps listen to our program regularly, that the Central Intelligence Agency financed so much of the terrorist movement. Why we were even taking the textbooks into Afghanistan in the mid-1980s, teaching the young boys there in Afghanistan and Pakistan how to add pictures of weapons, like two knives, three landmines, and four bullets is how many weapons, or teaching them how wonderful radical Islam was, how wonderful it was to kill for Allah and to die for Allah and to hate the infidels. And is it any surprise that sometime later, 15, 16 years later, why we find people who hate America, who join the Taliban, who join Al-Qaeda, radical Islamic movement was non-existent until the American CIA began to finance it in Afghanistan in the mid-1980s. It existed only in Saudi Arabia and was known as Wahhabism. Now it's spread throughout the world thanks to the fact that we recruited Arabs and Muslims throughout the world, brought them into Afghanistan to fight the Soviets, and in the process indoctrinated them in this radical belief that Allah was going to give them victory. And, of course, when they won the war against the Soviets, they believed that that the Afghan Arabs could do anything. Well, right now we have David Bay on the line, and we're talking about what the future holds, not simply in a movie with Tom Cruise, but, of course, for every American, if we don't understand that there is a conscious, organized effort to create a surveillance society, of course, in the name of fighting terrorism. David, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks, Dan. It's good to be here.
Well, it sounds like this is really a very gripping movie. Of course, Steven Spielberg is a wonderful director. He has a tremendous talent, and Tom Cruise is a great actor. But, of course, is this movie being used to condition the minds of the American people in preparation for something terrible and frightening?
Well, I believe it is. You alluded to the fact that that the war on terrorism goes back to the late 70s. And that's when I picked up, that's where the trail seemed to start for building up terrorism as the global threat that would result in the New World Order. So Hollywood has had a long time to prepare for this. I remember in mid-October of last year, which about 3 weeks after 9/11, about a month after 9/11. President Bush, in a speech, urged Hollywood to start producing movies and TV shows that supported the terrorism effort. And of course, right on cue, we started. Just a couple months later, we had several TV shows, and I believe this movie is one of those types of programs that Bush was talking about.
Well, it takes a couple of years to put together a TV program or certainly to put together a movie. It was really so interesting. I remember when the movie of the Pearl Harbor came out, and my first impression was, we're going to war again. I mean, obviously they're preparing the American people psychologically for war. It looks exciting and adventurous. And then, of course, we know that the Black Hawk Down and Weaver Soldiers movies had been in production for at least 2 years, and yet within 3 months of September 11th, there they were on the screen. And they were, somebody obviously was preparing the American people to change their emotional and mental outlook. Movies have a powerful impact, and I do not believe it was simply coincidence that those movies were there any more than that when simultaneously when we had the Three Mile Island incident. At that very time, a movie produced several years before with Jack Lemmon and Jane Fonda called The China Syndrome impressed on the minds of the American people the danger of a nuclear meltdown, and we just had to do away with, of course, nuclear energy because it was so dangerous. And since then, we've not built one new nuclear power plant, or we've just stopped the whole production of nuclear power plants. And that movie and that incident, which were timed, I mean, how could you possibly time the release of a movie to occur with an accident, or maybe it wasn't an accident?
Remember this, in 1999, Steven Spielberg's name popped up on the list of attendees to the Bilderberger conference.
Oh, did he really?
Yeah. So Steven Spielberg is an insider that could be trusted with some very sensitive information. And you're right. This is not an accident, and these movies were already in the pipeline. Whether how much the producers knew is another matter, but at least somebody knew enough to get them in the pipeline. My Minority Report, to me, is one of the most frightening movies I've ever seen for several reasons. Number one was the total surveillance. As we hear a lot these days in the daily news about retinal scanning, facial scanning, and other forms of surveillance. We now see cameras in many of the intersections downtown, in the downtown area.
They're putting them on the highways now.
They're putting them along the highways.
In some cities, they're putting them on the streets so that they can monitor. And if you go to Europe, you go to London, they have them literally on every street in downtown.
Well,
there,
and
of course, we're putting them up next to, in front of major buildings.
Right.
We went to the bank a couple of days ago. We had a little five-year-old with us. And, I was just doing what you do in a bank. And she said, look at all the cameras. And I'm looking up. And they must have had 8 to 10 cameras there in that bank. In other words, every place you went. Well, of course, we have to do that because of the wicked bank robbers, and I can understand the justification for having cameras in banks. But I think we will increasingly see cameras every place we go, always in the name, of course, of protecting law and order.
Right. In this movie, people were scanned readily as they got off of a commuter train. They were scanned as they walked down the street. They were scanned as they entered public buildings.
I think it's really so interesting, that at the Super Bowl either last year or the year before, they were using facial scanning. Now, what people don't know is that they went around to all the various states and bought pictures off the driver's licenses. And supposedly it was for a private company, but they were lying, as they always do. Actually, it was for the Secret Service that was buying up and giving large sums of money to buy your picture to put it into the computer so you could be facially scanned. Now, they tell us, of course, it's just for the criminals. But then anybody, of course, is a potential criminal, aren't they?
Well, that's true. And if the rules of society change, then who is declared a criminal also changes. And I think we're getting to that point as well. Back to the movie, the other thing that really bothered me is the theme of the movie is exactly what we've been doing to Middle Eastern type of people since 9/11, and that is, you know, we've been arresting men. There are reports that we have as many as 1,200 that have not been charged with a crime. They've not been allowed legal representation. They've been sent to jail without a release date. And in the minority report, citizens are arrested before they commit a crime. And they are taken right to jail. There's no legal representation. There's no rights read. There is no jury, trial by jury. And how this works in the movie is that, three human beings have been genetically altered to where they are extremely sensitive, psychics. I'm not sure if you know what remote viewing is, but it's an occult phenomenon in which psychics can actually see a long distance away. I really believe that it's the demonic host giving them the pictures of a scene halfway around the world, say. Both the CIA and the KGB have been using, have been experimenting with this for years. It would be a great advantage if one of our people could see something happening, half a world away, during a battle, for example, or spying on, on the enemy. But anyway, these three precognitives, as they're called, are kept in a pool of water. And they're outfitted with sensors. And as they see a murder about to be committed, then the authorities are informed and they get there before the crime is actually committed, and they arrest the person who would have committed the crime, and he goes right to jail.
It's sort of like this Padilla who, they've arrested, of course. Most people don't have much sympathy with him. He's Puerto Rican, an American citizen, has become a Muslim. He goes over there to somewhere in the Middle East, and we don't know. Did they have somebody set themselves up, agent provocateur, talking about dirty bombs? We have no idea, and nobody can find out because nobody can get to Mr. Padilla. Anyway, he comes back. He's an American citizen. He's arrested at the airport. He's transferred to military control, and we're told he'll be locked up without a trial until the war on terrorism is over. And we've already been told this may last for 50 years. It may last forever. Now, the idea that he's an American citizen, see, before we went along with the arresting of the Middle Easterners right after the terror attack because they weren't American citizens. But Padilla is an American citizen. But after all, to protect ourselves, we have to take away his rights. Well, what happens if this whole thing is contrived? Has there ever been a dirty bomb set off? Well, a dirty bomb would be a terrible thing, but there's never been a dirty bomb. In fact, it's so ridiculous, you would actually kill yourself if you had that much radiation, so you could wrap it around a stick of dynamite. But nobody ever points that out. You repeat over and over and over and over again the danger of a dirty bomb, and then people come to believe it, because it doesn't matter how ridiculous something is. If you say it often enough, people will believe.
Well, in our educational system, for at least the last 20 years, and probably longer than that, have been producing people who really can't read, really can't write anymore, haven't been taught critical thinking skills, and certainly haven't been taught that that historically, the number one threat to a person's life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness is their own government.
Sure.
And so we have a very complacent population, very concerned about that new house, that new job, that new career, and are really paying scant attention as to what's happening in Washington, D.C.
John F. Thomas Paine has said it very well. He said, all societies are good, but government, even at its best, is a necessary evil. And, of course, that's what it's really all about. That's why our founding fathers limited the power of government. They did not want a federal police force. They did not want a central intelligence agency that would be spying on Americans and violating its own laws and killing people in this country and throughout the world. And anybody who's ever studied the murder of President Kennedy, in fact, we have a wonderful book called Regicide, which is, of course, the records of the former director of covert operations, where he actually talks about how they planned and carried out the assassination, or at least financed it with your tax money. But, you know, people have to understand that the threat to freedom does not come from the mafia, because they worked for the CIA for years. The threat comes from government itself. Limit the power of government, and as John Locke had said so many years ago, that government governs best, it governs the least.
That's right. And you're talking about our founding fathers not wanting a lot of things. Another thing they did not want was a private agency that controlled the money. And of course, that was instituted in 1913 called the Federal Reserve. So there's a lot of things happening in Washington in the name of defending the Constitution, in the name of defending our liberties, that is actually working toward a plan that will take those all away.
And, of course, behind that is this age-old plan to create a one-world government and a new world religion. And behind everything that's going on are those dark spiritual forces, which have been there since the inception of mankind and certainly shortly after the inception of our own country. So I share your concern. Well, why don't you go ahead and tell us more about the story of the Minority Report?
Well, the Minority Report, Tom Cruise plays the lead part. His name is John Enderton, and he is the head of the pre-crime unit. He does have one superior who in the end turns out to be the really bad guy. But at the beginning, John Enderton believes in this wholeheartedly. They've gone a long way towards stamping out crime, especially murder. They've got thousands and thousands of people in jail. Even though this pre-crime idea, which had been going on 6 years at the time that the movie picks up the action, was just a test. It was just a test in Washington, D.C. They've got thousands of people in jail. Now, the jail is not what we think of as a jail, but it's a cryogenic, freezing capsule. And when a person is arrested, just before they commit the crime, they are not, like I said, they're not read it, they're right, because they have none. They are fitted with what is apparently a mind control, circular, device that looked like headphones that you would put on, and as soon as this goes on at the head of a person, they go into a sleep, and then they are put in the capsule and kept there for an indefinite period of time. Anyway, John Enderton is suddenly accused of plotting a murder 22 hours in the future. And so most of the show is about him running and how he escapes, there's a lot of close calls, but in this retinal society, a person that has their eyes on record is of course, it's very difficult for him to go anywhere. And certainly John Enderton needed to get back inside the department there. And like I said, he said, I'll be scanned 100 times before I get to the, back to the pre-crime, building. So, this retinal scan society has given rise to a black market of highly skilled eye surgeons that take your original eyes out and give you the eyes from someone else, and that is very macabre, and I found it very distasteful. But anyway, as John Anderton is recovering from his eye surgery, he was supposed to rest for 12 hours with bandages on, and then, you know, at least 12 hours, and he was in a room in a dilapidated old building that it was a tenement building, and you know, it was looked like public housing, and he was resting there with his gauze on, and the timer was set for 12 hours. Well, at the 9-hour point, you know, where he had 3 hours to go, suddenly the pre-crime unit looking for him arrives at this tenement building. And the retinal scanning is done by mechanical spiders. And that's just exactly what they are. They were little machines that could go under doors, and they had six or seven or eight legs, and they skidded across the floor, and they had retinal scanning capabilities, and they would come in under the door of all the rooms in this tenement building, unannounced and uninvited, and without any kind of corridor, and they wouldn't leave the room until they retinally scanned everybody in that room.
Just sounds sort of like the Patriot Act, doesn't it? The one they passed right after 9/11.
Exactly.
Of course, the government is going to be able to do all sorts of things without court orders and warrants, and come in and search your home without your ever knowing it, and take your things without your ever knowing it, but all in the name of fighting those wicked terrorists.
Now, these little mechanical spiders, they were all, of course, tied into a central network, and operators were watching what they were doing and what they were seeing, and this retinal scan capability with the spiders was enhanced by thermal imaging, and the thermal imaging probably from the satellite. Would tell the operator, all right, there's five people in this room, and the spiders have only gotten four scans, or there's one person in this room, and no spiders have got in here. So, and John Anderton was in one of those rooms, and he tried to escape by plunging himself into a deep tub that was in the bathroom there, and staying submerged. But that didn't work. They found him. The spiders sensed him in there, and finally he opened his gauze off of his eyes, even though he had 3 hours left to go, and let them retinally scan him, and of course those eyes were not John Anderson's eyes anymore, and so as it turns out he was able to see, even though he took the bandages off 3 hours early. And then you go through a series of other near escapes. He finally does discover that his boss is the one that set him up, and he's able to win the day. It comes down to, you know, good guys in the Justice Department sensing, you know, trying to prove that pre-crime arrests really were, you know, was or you know, it was not 100%. So you were on occasion jailing innocent people. And indeed, once the director of the pre-crime unit was discovered that he was manipulating the system, the Justice Department released every single person that had been arrested, you know, under this program in the last 6 years. So it ended on a good note, but in reality, there's not going to be any good guys in the government that are going to be fighting the bad guys. And this does set us up as a nation for the Hegelian dialectic debate to begin, you know, amongst ourselves as to whether this kind of arrest of people who have committed no crime is going to be allowed.
And I think the most frightening thing is the realization that we're seeing the surveillance society being posed today. We know that through echelon, why they tap our telephones, they tap our emails, they tap our faxes. It's all done electronically. And then, of course, if there's certain keywords or they feel that you're, the computer feels that you're talking in code, why they will actually then have real live human beings listen. But, of course, we know that the carnivore, they can get into our emails and computers. And we know, of course, that they're watching our bank accounts. And in fact, the banks are required, and they face terrible fines and penalties if they don't report anything that they consider unusual to the government. So, and of course, we know that any time we buy anything at the store and we use a charge card or we use one of these cards that they give us at the grocery stores, you know, supposedly so we get discounts, everything there goes into the computer.
Right.
They're compiling these massive files. They keep even the questionnaires that they give to your children in school. These are all kept in files. And any time they will ask children about their parents or what they have in the home or, you know, if there are guns in the home, some of these questionnaires, the parents never know. And this is exactly what you do in any totalitarian society. You say, well, why would anybody want a totalitarian society? Because the problem is that most people are good people. They are unable to understand the concept of evil. They're unable to understand there really are evil people out there. There has always been this conspiracy against God and God's people, and it's laid out so clearly in the scriptures in Jeremiah 11:9, in Ezekiel 22:25, in the second Psalm. And if you don't believe there's a conspiracy against God, then you don't believe in the Bible, because it's always been there, and we are living in a very exciting, a very difficult, a very frightening time in history. It's a wonderful thing to know the Lord, isn't it, David?
Yes. If you don't know the Lord as your Savior, and you know you're not born again, you have every reason to be absolutely terrified.
You can be terrified, but at least you know that the Lord is there, and He'll give us the way to get through what lies ahead, one way or the other.
I think it was C.S. Lewis that said that he thought Satan's greatest single triumph was when he was able to convince people that he did not exist. And people today don't believe in that Satan exists. He doesn't. They don't believe that God exists, and so they will believe in anything.
What I think of is G.K. Chesterton has said that those who disbelieve in God, it's not that they will believe in nothing; it's that they'll believe in anything. Right?
They'll believe in anything. Right. Now, the major biblical principle about mankind that people have totally lost sight of is that man is inherently evil. If you ask most people today, if you're taking a survey, is man inherently good or evil? Most people will say he's inherently good. And so when you lose the concept that man is inherently evil, as we see in Jeremiah 17:9. Where it says the heart is exceedingly deceitful and evil, and it's so evil that a person cannot even know the depths of their own evil. Once we lose concept of that, I believe that our free society and our liberties are doomed, because we will not recognize the danger as it's approaching.
No, I think you're so right, David. You know, the tragedy is that in many churches today, they don't talk about sin, and they certainly don't talk about Satan. In fact, so many of the sermons are aimed at making you feel good and warm and fuzzy. And yet, of course, the gospel points out that God is not only a God of love, but He's a God of justice. He is a God of judgment. And He's also a God of wrath. And somebody once said, if God were only a God of love, it would be the ultimate triumph of evil, because there'd be no punishment for sin, and there'd be no reason not to sin, and there'd be no reason not to do evil.
Well, most liberal churches today have made God into almost a grandfather figure, where, at the end of the age, they'll say, I can't punish. Well, you guys, just come on in. Everybody, come on in. And so... you're absolutely right that people do, churches are not teaching the Word of God anymore.
Well, we better get back to the old time religion. David, we're going to have to take 3 minutes here.
All right.
So if you want to get a cup of coffee or drink water, you go right ahead. We'll be right back here at Radio Liberty in just a moment, and we'll welcome your calls. It's 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when we have to remind our listening audience that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and we're really dependent upon you for what we do. We're on the air 5 hours a day, and now we're doing food programs on Saturday. Although I want you to know we will actually be cutting down to one program on Saturday. We will pre-record the other program during the week. But we're going to start a syndicated program on Saturday morning that will be heard right now on 6 stations, and hopefully we can get other stations to pull this down across America. And we hope that you'll pray for the success of that for us. That people have been very generous and provided the funding for that. And then, of course, one other thing we really want to do, and that will be get on this network that's offered us an excellent position, noon on Saturday, which is my favorite time. And, of course, once we get that, why, we'll be in fairly good shape. We'll have 47, almost 50 stations that are at least sharing some of our programming. And we're just going to have to hope and pray that many of you out there, if you're not already a member of the Radio Liberty family, will join. And if you are, that you'll be willing to make a commitment for 6 months. So we know we have the funding coming in. We're going to go ahead and hopefully over the next week or two, we can make a commitment there. So if you'd like to join the Radio Liberty family, we'd love to hear from you. Of course, we can be reached at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WARM. If you'd like to know more about our ministry, why, our website is www.radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. And, of course, you can pull down our newsletters. You can pull down probably close to 100 archive programs up there. We encourage you to copy them. We encourage you to circulate our material and to help us educate the American people as to the true nature of the spiritual battle in which we're engaged. We hope many of you will tell others about our program, and don't be upset if they don't listen. There is a spiritual blindness out there of people, but what you tell people, something you say to them, may very well they'll hear it from somebody else or from somebody else. And we're going to have to reach people one at a time through the media and the control of the media. The dark side controls the minds of so many good and wonderful people. But we can begin to break that down. We can begin to let people understand the miracle of America, why at one time we were a great and noble Christian nation, and how we lost the foundation of our freedom. So remember our telephone number again, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, and we hope that many of you will join the Radio Liberty family. We'd love to welcome you to become one with us. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening is David Bay of Cutting Edge Ministries. And David, why don't you get your website out there and other information on your ministry?
The website is www.cuttingedge.org, and this is Cutting Edge Ministries. And we bring two, or a double focus, to all news events and historical events in this whole plot to bring the global government into being. And that is a knowledge of Bible doctrine and prophecy on the one hand, and a knowledge of witchcraft on the other. I've been studying the occult for 16 years now. And that's important because in Daniel 8:23-25, it describes the religion of Antichrist, and it is black magic witchcraft. And then in Revelation 17:17, we see the ten kings are in tight league with Antichrist, in the plan to reorganize the world and set the stage for him to appear. So that means that the final 10 kings are also, you know, practitioners of black magic.
And I think that people have to understand that the witchcraft and the occult is the fastest growing religion in the world.
Yes.
It's growing far more rapidly than Christianity.
You know, it absolutely is. And, you know, we were talking before the break about how churches have stopped teaching about Satan and the occult. And I was talking with Pastor Ron Wright, who writes for, you know, our Pastor's Heart articles, and he said, you know, if churches were teaching about Satan and his kingdom and his power from the Bible the way they were 100-150 years ago, cutting edge ministries would never have been needed. But the fact of the matter is, churches haven't taught it for 100 years. Most people are not only biblically illiterate, but they are totally, you know, without understanding as to what the Bible teaches about Satan and his capabilities.
In fact, you know, there are an awful lot of churches that don't even believe in hell. Oh, hell is separation from God, and that's all that it is. And well, it is separation from God, but that's described very, very clearly in what the scriptures are.
Now, they don't believe it's a literal place of torment.
Right.
And, you know, even though, and they talk about Jesus being, you know, love, love, love. The fact of the matter is, the number one thing Jesus talked about was money. The number two thing he talked about was eternal torment. And the number three thing he talked about was the love he had for mankind. So, Jesus, taught us more about hell than all of the rest of the old, of the writers combined.
In fact, he talked far more about hell than he did about heaven. In fact, we have a wonderful 4-tape set on whatever happened to hell.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the most insightful interviews we've ever done. But, you know, most people aren't interested in that. However, for those who are interested in knowing about this and the fact that they simply changed the entire teaching of the scriptures with a modern church, because, of course, we don't believe in these ancient fables anymore, or maybe we should, because we've lost our vision of what the scriptures were. We're in the problems, or we face
but
the problems.
That's another thing. People have lost the concept that God is eternal and never changes. And that, you know, while Jesus changed the temple and, you know, code, the temple law, he never changed the moral law. So what made God angry 5,000 years ago makes him angry today?
Well, our telephone number is 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY. I thought maybe we'd move on to, is there anything else you want to say on this, or should we move on to the decision by the Ninth Circuit Court?
Let's move on to this decision.
All right, because I think that this really, of course, is very important, where the Ninth Circuit Court, or at least one judge there, said that, you know, of course, to have in the phrase, under God in the Pledge of Allegiance was unconstitutional. Now, you know, the most fascinating thing about that is, and there's probably not more than 1 in 1,000 people who know this, but when the Supreme Court opens its session every day, the crier comes in and says, God bless the United States and the Supreme Court. Now, they've been doing that for well over 200 years.
Right.
So why is it all right to open the Supreme Court every day with a phrase, under God, God bless this United States and Supreme Court, but not, of course, to mention God in schools. Certainly, if you go to the Supreme Court building, as I have, and you look there in the room where the Supreme Court justices sit, up above them there's this gigantic marble beam right close to the ceiling, and there engraved in the marble is a replica of the Ten Commandments. Certainly, the Senate opens every day with a prayer. The Congress opens every day with a prayer, but we can't have prayer in school. Now, the reason we can't have prayer in school is because they want the soul of your children. That's what it's really all about. But you see, the American people don't understand that. They don't understand there are wicked and evil men who've been placed on the Supreme Court to destroy the Christian foundation of this nation, because if you destroy the Christian foundation of America, you not only destroy the country, you destroy Western civilization. And that's what this is really all about.
Well, it's not, you know, of course, it's not just on the Supreme Court. We have those kind of judges. We have them throughout the entire federal system.
Right.
This particular system happened to be one of the most liberal we have. And it was, I believe it was a 2-1 decision. But it doesn't make sense from the aspect that you just mentioned, it also doesn't make sense in the fact that this is probably not going to be upheld by the Supreme Court, maybe overruled by them, and certainly it's produced a tremendous backlash. But what I believe this does is, there's a couple things it does. Number one is that it starts the debate. And we talk, you know, in Cutting Edge Ministries, we talk about a Hegelian dialectic plan that we call the six-step attitudinal change plan that gradually changes people's attitudes over a period of time. And once a person's attitude has been changed on a subject, that person believes with their, you know, that they arrived at that new value, that new attitude all on their own.
No.
But the main thing in this six-step plan is to start a debate.
And of course, this whole idea is conflict. Conflict is how you change.
Control conflict.
Right. And of course, you get two views. You get the ones who say, well, this is, you know, we should have prayer in school, and then you get the one that says we shouldn't have prayer in school because it violates the wall of separation between church and state. And then you argue out of that, and then you come up with a new concept, whatever it may be. And then that new concept becomes something that you debate over. And the whole idea is to keep the debate going and the conflict going all the time, because out of conflict comes change. This is a long-range plan. They know exactly what they're doing. They're playing games with our minds.
Now, see, and this debate, which is step two in this, you know, step one is what happened, you know, day before yesterday. A controversial subject is made public by a respected expert speaking from a respected forum, and the respected experts, of course, are these judges, and their forum is the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. And step two is that people are outraged, and so you've immediately got a debate started, a controlled conflict, and then sheer repetition is step four, and that is just battling back and forth, and the target are those people whose minds are not set in concrete, okay? So conservatives are not going to be, are far less likely to be a victim of this attitudinal change plan than someone who doesn't really know what they believe on a particular subject.
Well, we've got Tony calling in from SoCal. Hi, Tony. Do you have a question or comment?
Yeah, hi, Dr. Stan.
Hi, how are you doing?
Oh, good, good. Yeah, I have a question, something I've been wondering about all day, actually. And it has to do a little bit with the Ninth Circuit decision, but it also has to do with the voucher decision, because I see the two as being linked. And the reason why I see these two as being linked, first of all, you're probably going to think I'm a heretic on this one, but according to Supreme Court precedent, which goes back to 1947 in that Everson versus Board of Education case, when the Supreme Court said that if the government spends even a dime of taxpayer money, it establishes religion, when it took Thomas Jefferson's letter to the Denver Baptists totally out of context, they basically said that anything that has anything to do with the government establishes religion. So according to that Supreme Court decision, I think this Ninth Circuit, in actuality, made the right call.
You made the right call.
According to Supreme Court precedent.
All right, according to Supreme Court precedent, but and you're absolutely right, Tony, except the fact that the Constitution is the law, not the judges.
I understand that. But you see, now in the voucher case, okay, which just came out, I've got the 98 pages on my desk. My son got it for me. I haven't read it yet. Now, they've reversed themselves on Everson because now they're saying that tax money can go to parochial religious schools. So they, now my question is, have they thrown out Everson in totally, or have they just done it in for this one particular case?
All right, David, did you get Tony's question?
Well, I'm not familiar with that precedent, but I can tell you that the voucher system is a Trojan horse because once, you know, it's been established that once a teaching institution, an educational institution accepts or, you know, allows students to spend government money to attend there, then the government has the right to step in and start dictating curricula.
Whatever the government subsidizes, the government will control, right?
That's right. That's right. And that's why you've got certain Christian colleges out there who don't allow their students to use government programs, you know, to attend the school. And so the voucher system itself is a Trojan horse, and people should be aware of it.
I think that's absolutely right. Tony, I think the thing is that we no longer have rule by law. We have rule by men. I think that they really want the vouchers. We want to get our children out of government schools, but we're not going to do it by having the government pay for our private schooling.
Right.
Because once they begin paying for private schooling, they will control private schooling. What you're dealing with, of course, is organized schizophrenia as far as the court is concerned. And there's no consistency at all because we do not have men and women who are interpreting the Constitution. We have men and women who are carrying out a political agenda. And, of course, once you have that taking place, you're well on your road to tyranny. We were to be a nation of law, not a nation of men. Anything else, Tony?
Well, I'm still going to keep my eyes and ears open on this because if Everson has been thrown out, and I know that Rehnquist is on record as wanting to throw, it's called Everson versus Board of Education.
1947.
If Everson is thrown out, that's that whole basis they use, they call it the Lemon Law for determining whether there's a violation of church and state. It's all based on that case. Now, if they've thrown that case out, okay, then they have to go back and revisit all of the other cases that they have made based on that, like the TAL, you know, school prayer, Bible in the school. They have all those cases and reverse their decisions.
Well, but you see, Tony, you're looking at this logically. You have to understand none of this is logical.
Well, I understand that.
Okay, anything else, Tony?
But, well, I'm just really curious to know if they have totally scrapped Everson versus Board of Education, or if they've only sidestepped it for this one thing.
Well, I think that they'll do exactly what they want to do because they don't believe in the law. At one time, the Constitution was the law of the land, and now it's, of course, whatever the Supreme Court judges say.
Well, see, the Constitution now, they call it a living document.
Right.
In other words, it can mean whatever they want it to mean.
Right, and of course that is the road to tyranny. Hey, thanks so much, Tony.
Well, I appreciate it. You keep your eyes and ears open on that one. If you do hear anything, if you could pass it on.
All right, God bless. We'll just keep listening, and maybe we'll have somebody a lot smarter than we are on here.
Okay,
bye. Okay, fine. Our telephone number 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY. If you have a question or comment. Why, we've got another 10 or 11 minutes here. We'd love to hear from you. But I think that, of course, what we're seeing is the destruction of the foundations of our freedom. You go back and read Thomas Jefferson, and he talked about his fear that the Supreme Court was basically had within it the seeds of destruction of the country that he loved. And, of course, Jefferson, whether you like him or not, is certainly one of the most brilliant men of all time. And one of the things he said, and I shall never forget it, was that, and I've got it right here, and he said, everything predicted, no, I'm sorry, well, anyway, go ahead.
What?
Oh. Go right ahead.
I'm just going to say that one thing that this does is that it strikes a blow, at least a rhetorical blow, against national sovereignty, because the Pledge of Allegiance is a very important part of our identity as a nation. And of course, there has long been a concerted effort to move people's attitudes away from love of one's country, so that they will become good global citizens. Their country that they love will be the global government, not an individual government.
But of course, that's what it's really all about. It is about the one world government.
Yes,
that is what they want: a one world government, a one world religion. Let's go to Aaron, who's calling us from Boulder Creek. Hi, Aaron. How are you doing?
Hi, Dr. Dan.
Can you get us? Are you listening to us on the radio or on the internet up there?
I'm on the cell phone. I'm listening to you on the radio. Though.
All right,
the radio
fine.
Is turned down.
Okay, go ahead.
I just have a perspective on you and your guest have suggested that the Supreme Court decision regarding the schools is sort of inconsistent with the Ninth Circuit Court's decision, but I'm not certain that that's entirely correct. My point of view on this is that the Ninth Circuit Court was relatively clear in saying that their issue was that they felt that this particular inclusion in the Pledge of Allegiance asserted one particular religion over others and wasn't, per se, symmetric to all religions, which was apparently the test that was applied by the Ninth Circuit Court. Now, in the case of the Supreme Court decision, there's no, per se, that it's only okay to give money to Christian schools. They have, in fact, opened the door in general to the government subsidizing religious schools associated with any religion. And if you apply the same test that the Ninth Circuit Court applied, then it seems perfectly reasonable that I could open it, say, Wiccan school or whatever, and the government would be willing to provide vouchers for citizens who wanted to leave the public schools and come to my religious school for any religion. So I think actually the two decisions are entirely consistent when seen in that point of view.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your view, and let's go to Ron.
I'll hear what you and your guests have to say about that.
All right. You have any thoughts at all on
that? I think in a sense he's right. When you accept government money for a program, not only does the government control it, but you can set up a school for whatever religion that you want to promote.
Well, you see, where everybody's missing the point is that there is no place in having to do with the federal government for providing funds for any education. What the government can do is very specifically prescribed in Article 1, Section 8, and everything else is restricted by the Ninth and Tenth Amendments to the Constitution. We ought to get governments completely out of education.
But, you know, that's been turned so completely on its head, Stan, that now, for some time now, a couple of decades, we've been spending more on education than we have on the Defense Department.
That's right, and actually George W. Bush massively increased the budget of the Department of Education, and Bill Clinton has suggested doing what George Bush has done. Why, we would have said he's a big spender.
Well,
when George Bush increases something like $10 billion for federal aid to education and massively expands control over education, the Christians flock and say, isn't it wonderful that we have a Christian in the White House?
I'll tell you something. Since World War II, it is a fact that more freedoms have been lost under a quote unquote conservative Republican president and under any any liberal that we've ever had.
Well, of course, seven of the nine Supreme Court justices who were taking away our freedom were appointed by Republican presidents. Let's go to Ron in Vitsland. How are you doing, Ron?
Well, fine, Dr. Stan. I just wanted to make a few comments. I got a phone call from someone soliciting money from a university. They got my name by mistake. And the gal who was soliciting the money was a political science major. So I just wanted to query her a little bit to see about how knowledgeable she was on political science. So I asked her, what's the supreme law of the land? And, of course, she didn't know. So then I informed her that it's the Constitution. If you read Article 6, the Constitution and the laws of the United States, which shall be made in pursuance thereof, and all treaties made, which shall be made under the authority of the United States, shall be the supreme law of the land, and the judges in every state shall be bound thereby.
And amen to that. Well, of course,
they don't believe that anymore.
Well, they don't teach that in school.
Well, Well, then I asked her, I said, well, the Constitution is the supreme law of the land. I said, do you know how they change it? And she said, yeah, some judge makes a decision. I said, no. It's very difficult to change it. It has to be like, two-thirds of each house, and it has to be voted on by three-fourths of the state legislature. I said, it's very difficult to amend the Constitution. It's called the amendment process. Well, at that, she hung up on me.
But she was more right than you'll give her credit for. In these past several decades, you know, much of our Constitution has been overridden and or watered down or even downright reversed, and you know, by judges' decisions.
But she should know the foundations of our freedom.
Of course,
well,
that's
fact,
right.
She does
of
reflect. I hope you didn't give any money to the
University. Bell Pacific University. I wouldn't. But one other thing, in Article 7, it says, done in convention by the unanimous consent of the states present, the 17th day of September in the year of our Lord.
My goodness, don't let the Supreme Court know that. They'll take that out of the Constitution.
Well, I'll tell you, it isn't for the Wiccans and the Allah and all this other stuff. The year of our Lord. They can live here, and they'll stand before God. And if they don't have Jesus Christ, they're going to go to hell.
Well, of course.
And that's their business.
At one time,
our country is under God.
At one time, everybody knew this was a Christian nation. Unfortunately, of course, that fact has been simply censored from our reality. Hey, thanks so much for calling, Ron. We're out of time.
Yes, sir.
Bye-bye. Okay, well, it's been a fascinating hour. Do you have any parting thoughts for our listeners right now?
Well, I just want to say that we are, you know, the rate of change, you know, that you know, in our systems of government and in our constitutional liberties, the rate of change to take all that away is just accelerating.
You're absolutely right.
And it's accelerating at the same time that all of the end time prophecies are coming together at once, just as Jesus foretold. And so we need to be very aware. We need to be in much prayer and spread the gospel far and wide.
Amen to that. Well, thank you so much. Our guest has been David Bay of Cutting Edge Ministries. You can get the website at www.cuttingedge.org. Do you have a telephone number you want to put out?
1-800-451-8211.
451-8211. God bless you, David.
Hey,
it's been a great program. Thanks so much, and we'll look forward to having you with us in the not-too-distant future.
Amen.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, and this is Dr. Stan, and of course, this is the time when we have to say good night to our listeners up there in the Northwest, and we ask you to pray for America. We ask you to pray for our leaders, for our ministers. We ask you to pray for revival in America, because, of course, if the American people don't turn back to God, why, God will turn his back on America. And then we ask you, of course, to pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for my family, for our staff. We ask you to keep us in your prayers. Till tomorrow at the same time, Dr. Stan, good night, and may the Lord be with you. Well, good evening. This is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, and supporters of this station. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, of course, we always welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being. We have with us in studio Lucy Carter, and Lucy is with the Samaritan's Purse, Franklin Graham's organization, and she is working with Operation Christmas Child, a project of Samaritan Purse that delivers gift-filled shoes, boxes to children in desolate places. Lucy, thank you so very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, to tell us a little bit about what you're doing, apparently you're going to be having a big meeting up in the Bay Area in the near future.
We're having a meeting tomorrow because we're training some key volunteers and collection center coordinators, and pretty soon we'll be part of Spirit West Coast Conference in Monterey because we'll have an exhibit there and a representative.
All right, fine. Well, now, where is the conference tomorrow?
It will be in Vallejo at the Castlewood Baptist Church.
All right, and then when will you be down here in the Monterey area? Because that's Vallejo is a little far. Of course, you actually came all the way down there from Vallejo today, didn't you?
Yes, I did.
Okay, fine. When will you be over there in Monterey?
I believe that's in July.
Okay, so that's not that far away. And I hope that you'll go ahead and get us the date and how people can go to that meeting. Now, are these training meetings, how do they work? What's this? What is your function in this? You are sort of a coordinator for the program?
Yes, I represent Operation Christmas Child for the West Coast. That would include California and also Nevada and Hawaii.
Okay, fine. And, of course, what do you hope is that people will prepare Christmas boxes for children? And whereabouts are they distributed?
They're distributed in more than last year. We went to more than 94 countries. This year we'll probably exceed 100 countries. We'll be distributing, if we meet our goal, which I hope that we will, we have so far every year, of 6 million shoeboxes from 10 countries. We'll distribute them in more than 110 countries.
In other words, basically, these are collected not just here in the United States, but in other first world countries?
In 10 countries, yes.
All right, fine. And so what are those 10 countries you know of, Pam?
Yes, they are Canada, of course the U.S., Finland, Germany, the Netherlands, Germany, Ireland.
Well, anyway, so basically the first world countries, European
countries. United Kingdom.
Right. And so so you're actually out there, and now you have the responsibility then for the West Coast.
Yes.
And, of course, this is the time to start thinking about Christmas time, and that's why you're doing it right now.
Yes, we actually work year-round at this. And,
all right.
And tomorrow we're looking forward to meeting with some of the key volunteers in the area, and there are people who volunteer to collect the shoeboxes for us regionally and to get these boxes to relay centers and from there to collection centers. We have a network of collection centers throughout the United States.
Well, are there any here in the Santa Cruz or Monterey Bay area where people, if they wanted to get started, could get started now?
We have one in San Jose at the Foxbury Church, and we have one in Vallejo at Castlewood Baptist. We have an 800 number.
All right. Why don't you give that out? If you have anybody out here in Santa Cruz or in the Monterey Bay area, where this program is reaching, of course, it's reaching nationwide on the Internet, but right now, let's get the 800 number where people can call.
800-353-5949.
All right, that's 800-353-5949. Right. Now, what sort of things would the people put in these shoeboxes?
Well, there are several categories. One would be a very important category is toys.
Right.
These children need to have a little joy in their lives. So toys, in the way of food, no perishable foods, but hard candy, school supplies, and hygiene products.
Okay.
And do not include any war toys. Some of these places, the children see a lot of war, and we don't want war toys.
Well, you know, I think, Lucy, the problem is that we live in a utopian society. I mean, you know, here we have so much abundance and so many things and, you know, peace and, you know, of course, we are always concerned when there's a robbery, you know, two towns away from us. But as you point out, some of the children in countries throughout the world, in Africa and Asia, death is a way of life to them. I mean, it's so difficult for the average American to understand, you know, that children are brought up in this sort of an atmosphere, and children are being orphaned as children. Many of them don't even know where their next meal is coming from.
It's true. They have a culture of death, many of them, and we have a culture of life, and that's very, very different. And we offer something that offers hope, which is the gospel, and representing Christ in all the work that we do.
Well, of course, that is really the only solution for anyone, anywhere in the world today. And so, basically, when you're distributing the shoe boxes, and people just take a shoe box, do they wrap them up in some sort of Christmas decorations or what?
They take any empty shoe box and fill it for a boy or a girl. If they do one box, they choose boy, girl, and they choose an age category. And the age categories are 2 to 4, 5 to 9, and 10 to 14. And then we ask that they include $5 in an envelope to help us with the cost of shipping. When they fill the box, they fill it according to their own taste and whatever, you know, enjoyment they get out of choosing gifts for a boy or a girl or according to the age category, but within the guidelines that we have, which are spelled out in a brochure that they can receive through calling the 800 number.
All right. That 800 number again is 353-5949. And so, I suppose putting these big container ships and just ship throughout the world, and you have a staff in many of these countries?
Yes, we have national partners. In fact, we try not to go out in the world and be Santa Claus, you know. We just want to equip our national partners, the Christian Church, in countries around the world, give them a tool for their work. They want to work and to spread the gospel, and they need tools. So that is what we're providing. This is like a foolish thing to confound the wise. What's in a shoebox? You know, it's just a little gift, but yet it tells so much because it's a message of love as well. It has things in it that they can use, but it's also an opportunity to include a brochure that has the gospel in their language.
Well, I think that, of course, is such an important thing. Now, what exactly is your organization? What is Samaritan's Purse?
Samaritan's Purse is an international Christian relief and evangelism organization, which is headed by Franklin Graham. He's the oldest son of Dr. Billy Graham. It's a nonprofit organization, and it specializes in meeting the critical needs of victims of war, poverty, disease, and natural disaster. And we do that in order to demonstrate God's love and to earn a hearing for the gospel. Our headquarters are in Boone, North Carolina, but we have other offices as well, in Australia, Canada, Germany, the Netherlands, and also the United Kingdom.
Now, what then exactly is Operation Christmas Child? This is basically what we're talking about, is this actually putting together the shoeboxes for children. So what is Operation Christmas Child?
Well, let me go back just a little bit. In 1970, Samaritan's Purse was started by Bob Pierce. He is the same man who founded World Vision and co-founded other organizations that are really still running and wonderful today. And he wanted Samaritan's Purse to be very Christ-centered, that we, yes, do humanitarian work, spread love and help and aid, but always in the spirit of Christ. And so in 1978, Bob Pierce commissioned Franklin Graham to take over the organization. And it's been going since then, providing medical help, doctors and medicines and equipment around the world, as well as relief services, for example, when there's an earthquake or there would be, say, famine, war, and we're there. We identify the need and try to help. And we also do things like in Kosovo, where there were so many thousands of refugees building a refugee camp. But as the years progressed, we came across Operation Christmas Child, and this was in 1993. A gentleman had started that. It was called something else at the time, Boxes of Love or something like that, to help kids in Romania. And he asked Franklin if, you know, he would consider helping with that, putting out the word. Franklin did, and it came under then the organization Samaritan's Purse.
Well, I know we have some friends who go over to the Sudan. I don't know, you probably don't know Peter Hammond's ministry over there, but I know that Franklin Graham has had a hospital there that really has been one of the few ministries that really would go down and help the Christians in the southern Sudan. And, of course, it's a very dangerous thing to do, but
yes.
There's only maybe three or four organizations that are really there. A lot of them are sort of going along with the United Nations and, giving the supplies to the United Nations. And, of course, then they don't go to the Christians. They go to the people who are killing the Christians. But I know that Franklin Graham's unit over there has really been very helpful. And it also, of course, the people there are risking their lives on a daily basis.
Oh, yes. We have a real heart for to help in Sudan. In fact, we have a hospital in Rui, Sudan, which was bombed by the government, which is a Muslim government, several times last year. It's very sad because it's the only hospital for miles. You know, there's lots of people there, and they were bombing this hospital. And we're still running the hospital. A doctor had to leave for a while, but we're still doing that. In fact, are you aware that there are some Sudanese refugees here in the U.S. in the last 6 to 12 months? They have come, about 3,800 of them helped through the United Nations and some Catholic charities. And so there are some ministries trying to help them. We have about 90 of those fellows in San Diego.
Well,
there are some ministries trying to help them.
They're good people and they love the Lord, and it's just such a terrible, impossible situation over there, where, of course, you will be killed or enslaved for your faith. And slavery still continues today, and yet, of course, we look the other way. In fact, the majority of the money that was raised by the China Petrol to develop the oil over there to finance the Muslim government was raised on American financial markets. And there's something wrong with the picture, but that's neither here nor there. Right now we're talking about Operation Christmas Child. So what basically is Operation Christmas Child? How does it work? How does it function? And how does it impact on the lives of these young people?
All right. Well, as I going back to 1993 when we took it on, and from that time on, our goal was to help children around the world with a message of love and also to spread the gospel. And so it's not only to them, but also to their parents and caretakers. Every day, boys and girls worldwide suffer from war, poverty, disease, and natural disaster, and Operation Christmas Child makes it possible for millions of these children to experience God's love through these shoeboxes right here in the U.S. and in this area. And so in last year, with the help of many caring individuals and groups, Operation Christmas Child touched the lives of more than 5.4 million children in 94 countries. And it is done just by people taking a box and filling it with gifts and taking it to the nearest collection center. And then we take them and we process the boxes. We check with many, many volunteers in our processing centers, of which there are 7 in the U.S. We inspect the shoe boxes. And then we send them by airplane, by ship, by truck, every which way. We reach really remote locations with these gifts of love. We ship them to the national partners that we have. For example, in Ukraine, it's New Life Church in Kyiv. And they use it not only as a tool to help the kids in orphanages and street children and churches, but also for church growth. And it works because they invite children, they set a goal, let's say 100 children are to be invited from the neighborhood through their parishioners, and they say, we're going to distribute gifts. So they come, and some of them come back to church again once they are introduced to the church and like the church. It's a wonderful church, that one in Kyiv. And they keep coming back, so the church grows and grows and grows because year after year, because of these distributions and because of the way that this national partner uses the tool. They have had to actually start churches. During the war in Bosnia in the early 90s, there were very few Christians in that area. Now there are thousands and thousands of Christians through this distribution of shoebox gifts, if you can believe that.
Well, I can believe it. Well, God works in strange ways. Now, of course, who pays for the project?
The individuals who make the shoebox will pay by buying the things that are in the shoebox. But, you know, any budget will do. You can buy inexpensive things or expensive things according to your own taste and budget. And, of course, the $5 or more that you would include. We also receive donations to the ministry. They're not designated, say, for something else. It's members, first, who can use it for Operation Christmas Child.
All right. And who can be involved in the Operation Christmas Child?
Individuals and groups, churches, service clubs, If you as an individual hearing this want to know how to do it, just take any empty shoebox, fill it, call the 800 number. We'll tell you where it should go. If you do it during the year before we're actually collecting, and we're collecting November 18 through 25 at our collection centers, but at any other time besides that, call the 800 number and they'll give you the address in Boone, North Carolina to send it to you. If you're a church, there's no cost to the church itself, you know, the missions budget or anything like that, to do this, because we provide our materials free of charge. That is, we provide the brochures and an information kit, a videotape that, you know, that explains the project, Franklin speaking in it. Some of the distributions are shown in this videotape. It's a very touching videotape, very informative, and you can use it to promote the project in your church or in your school or in your service club. So anyone can do this. And in fact, a lot of people who do this are not necessarily Christian. I think of the giving and the receiving and as being in three levels. One is the material level. You can, let's say you're not a very spiritual person. You can, but you want to help, and this is a vehicle. Operation Christmas Child is a vehicle by which you can get a gift to some foreign land, and you would have no assurance that sending a gift to a child somewhere will really get there, and it would be very, very costly. Whereas, if you want to use this organization to do it, you can think of it as a gift to a needy child that, you know, has material things in it that they can use. And then another level would be emotional. You touch someone's life. You know, a child who wrote in said, I received this gift and it had these things in it, and I can't believe that someone in some other part of the world far away thought of me. I keep your picture next to me all the time. Thank you. So that is an example of the emotional touch. And then there's a spiritual level. As a Christian or a spiritual person, you can send a gift with that person's soul in mind. And you can pray for the gift of the things, even as you are shopping, that the Lord will help you to choose the things that someone He has in mind will receive and will need, would like to have. So your gift can go with any of these things in mind, or all three, emotional, material, and spiritual. So anyone can get involved, and it can receive that at any level as well.
Well, now, of course, this is the first time I've heard about this project. We've been doing talk radio now for, 7 or 8 years here. And so have you actually come into this area before to get the Christmas boxes, or is this, are you really now systematically beginning to organize the West Coast? Are you relatively new on this job, or you've been doing it for a long time?
Well, actually, on September 11th, it will be my 6th year.
Really? Have you been covering the West Coast all this time?
Yes, I have. California, and now we've added those other two states, okay. Nevada and Hawaii, and every year I take a tour, because I'm from Southern California, and most of my time is spent in our West Coast office in Santa Ana, but every year I plan a tour, a week, say, in the Bay Area, or Central California, coastal, northernmost, or southernmost California. So I spend some time, you know, touring the whole state throughout the year, and this is my first time here.
Okay, fine.
This section right here.
So this first time in the Monterey Bay area, is that so?
Yes, except for that, I was participating in the Spirit West Coast Conference last year.
All right, fine. And so then you'll let us know when this meeting is going to be over there in Monterey in July, and we'll be glad to put the information out and see if people would be interested in going. Now, will that be put on, would you put that on, will that be put on by Franklin Graham, or who will coordinate that?
Actually, we are simply going to have a booth there and have a representative there, and that is the only role that we will have at the Spirit West Coast Conference.
Okay.
We did last year, we'll do it again this year. So if anyone's interested who is planning to go there, look us up.
Well, you mentioned Spirit West Coast. I'm not acquainted with that. Why don't you tell us just a little bit about that as well? What is the Spirit West Coast Conference?
I really don't know too much about it. I just know that it happens every year. It's very, very, very big, and that we have been invited to have a booth there. Some Christian ministries are represented with their booths. And there's many, many Christian bands that are playing at all times, lots of activity.
Well, now, where is this? Is this the fairgrounds over there?
Yes.
And this is Monterey?
In Monterey.
I see. I'll talk to you afterwards. It's something that we want to popularize our ministry with the Christians. An awful lot of people don't even know we have a Christian radio station right here in the Monterey Bay Area. Now, of course, what sort of other projects is Samaritan's Purse involved in, you know, other than what you're doing?
Well, for example, in North Korea, which is a very, very closed country, there has been an epidemic of tuberculosis. And we have a World Medical Mission, that arm of the ministry, project there that's pretty big. And we can help people with tuberculosis. I mean, there 85% of the cases we can actually, help and cure.
That's because you have to have the medicine.
You have to have the medicine. They need the medicines. We can get them from South Korea. And so for only $85, for instance, as we receive donations, you can help cure one person. And over there, tuberculosis, one case will spread to 12 other people in 1 year.
Sure.
So it's a real epidemic. I believe as of last year, 2 million people were infected with full-blown tuberculosis. So that's an example of what we do there. And around the world, we'll have houses and clinics for children with HIV and with AIDS. For example, in Romania, we have Rachel's House, and we help children who are dying with AIDS, with spiritual and medical help. We try to give them the hope that Christ lives in us and that there is life after death. But basically, we just want to give them the hope and the love of Christ, that they're not alone. And so we do help children with AIDS around the world and treat children. And we help, for example, in El Salvador, in Central America, where the Hurricane Mitch, had caused such devastation. We built homes. And in some other areas, maybe it's roofs. Or, for example, in Kosovo, we committed to help 2,000 families by winterizing one room per family. So if three families live together in one home, we winterize three rooms for these families so that they can survive the winter.
Yeah, well, because the devastation that was over in Kosovo, I think the average American would find difficult to believe. And I know, of course, would either a Muslim or a Christian or just anybody in need.
Anybody in need.
Right.
In fact, since we're representing Christ, we hope to represent Him among the Muslims and unbelievers. That's the heart of the ministry.
Of course it is. Well, do you have much of an outreach in the Muslim countries, or is that pretty well closed to Christian missionaries?
We actually do. It's difficult. We have to, it's very difficult to do, but we do it. For example, in Sudan, there are some moderate Muslims that we reach that are actually interested. They have been marginalized. A certain group of Muslims have been marginalized by their government. And so they have invited us and wanted us to help them, and their hearts are fostered to the gospel.
Now, is this in northern Sudan or southern Sudan?
Southern Sudan I am referring to at the moment. Yes.
Okay.
So there are cases where we have a way in because of the work that we do or because maybe they're not extremists. And, of course, in Kosovo, we worked a lot with Muslims. We helped a lot the Muslims. And so that opens the door of their heart, to hearing what we have to say.
I think it's a wonderful, wonderful thing. In many ways, I wish I could be doing that, but I sort of think that I've been called to doing what I'm doing now. What about this Afghanistan? I understand that you have a ministry over in Afghanistan, this horrible war-torn country.
Yes. And we're identifying needs still, but we are making a distribution now of 300,000 shoebox gifts.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Now, there are times that we cannot include the gospel brochure, but in 90 to 95% of the cases, we can. In cases like this, we can't. For example, in North Korea or in Afghanistan. But there in Afghanistan, we hope to be able to set up clinics and help with medicine and medical help in general, because there are some places where there is none, no medical help. And then we distribute the gifts and show the love of Christ. Something I want to share from my heart is that one of the biggest, greatest gifts we can give is hope. Because there are so many hopeless people. If I can just share a story about that, that's in my heart. It has to do with a representative from the Appalachian Mountains named Mary Dameron, and she works for us now. She comes from a very, very poor area, and she was inspired to get involved with Operation Christmas Child and collected in the first year, living in the hollows of West Virginia between the two poorest counties in the U.S. She collected 1,200 gifts from her area. And that's how she became acquainted with Franklin Graham, and began to go to Bosnia and get travel around the world because she had very special gifts because of where she came from. She says she came from a war-like situation where she lived and in her own family. So when she was in Bosnia, she went to speak to some children who had survived bombings. A teacher had saved their lives, 42 children. And so the teacher had told them that Mary was going to come and that she had gifts for them. So they prepared a poem in the form of a song. And in this poem, they described a world without hate, without war. They described flowers everywhere and no hate. Everyone loved each other. And they went on and on describing this idealistic place that to them does not exist and never has existed. And when they were done and they gave this in writing to Mary, Mary says, can I speak to them now? And she spoke to them and she said, children, you said that this is an imaginary land. She said, let me tell you about heaven. There actually is a place. And she described the streets of gold and the streams and rivers and waterways. And she described a king and a throne. And she says, and that king is my father. He can be your father. And she began to tell them about the gospel and the gospel brochure that she was giving out with these gifts. And the teacher was so touched by this and the fact that it was hope that she gave her the only thing she had, and that was a ring that came from her husband who also had been killed. And she would not accept Mary's rejection of this ring. She said, your gift to us is greater than my gift could ever be to you. Please accept it. You gave us the gift of hope. He says, and I'm going to read through that gospel brochure, and if I find and feel that it is true, I will not rest till every single child in this group understands and has a chance to know and to receive this this gospel. So that's just an example of the gift of love and the gift of hope that this project represents.
Well, I think it's a wonderful, wonderful ministry, and certainly everything I've heard about A Samaritan Purse separates from so many of the other ministries out there, and we're really very, very proud of Franklin Graham. He's taken very courageous stands on a number of things, and certainly will not back down when he believes in something and believes it very strongly. So, and I think that for the average individual here in the United States, what's going on over there is all make-believe. It's almost like going to a motion picture, and we see on the screen this make-believe world. The tragedy is that, in many instances, is far closer to reality than where we live, because most of the people live in this world without hope, this sense of hopelessness, where the idea is, life is tough and then you die. And, of course, we have so much to offer. And I think this is really a wonderful way we can share with others the abundance that God has given us, at least for the time being. So now, if somebody wants to get involved, do you have any outlets or anybody right here in the Santa Cruz or Monterey Bay area now who would be able to collect gifts for you?
We have the, just in San Jose, the collection center. So we may actually acquire more places that will act as collection centers for us, and that 800 number will have that latest information as we acquire other collection centers closer. We'd like to have closer places.
Well, this would be an idea if there was somebody here listening to this program who would like to take that on as a project. And do you usually use a church, or what do you use?
Usually a church, yes. We'll volunteer to collect for us.
Okay, and then, of course, imagine that the church does collect for you. What do they do? They've got this whole garage full of shoe boxes.
Mm-hmm.
So, then what happens?
They take it to our official collection center in Vallejo or in San Jose. And
I've got 6,000 boxes. How am I going to get those up to Vallejo?
Well, you take them by truck or caravan. Now, if we establish, we don't establish official collection centers less than about an hour and a half from each other.
Okay.
Because of the cost involved in sending trucks. If we need to establish a collection center in an area, then we send a truck and provide the trailers to that place. So that's something that is established through, again, the 800 number when we need new collection centers in an area. We try to keep them an hour and a half to 2 hours apart.
All right, fine. Well, we're going to be back in just a moment. We're going to take a three-minute break. And when we get back, we'll invite your calls at 464-8295 or 1-888. true for liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan here, and this is a time when we have to remind you that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and we hope that many of you out there will decide that you want to help us do what we do on a regular basis. So please, if you believe in what we stand for, if you believe that we have a message that you're not going to get elsewhere, and you'd like to have us be able to reach other people, why, please give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WARM. And of course, the people who join the Radio Liberty family of supporters ordinarily will get our four best tapes of the month. They get our monthly newsletter, but more than that, they're helping us do what we do. What we do is 5 hours every day. We are on radio programs and various networks. We actually do 2 hours on Saturdays, and through that we have an opportunity on shortwave, on satellites, on the internet, 5 hours of internet a day. We, of course, are heard not only here in the United States, but all over the Western Hemisphere, really all over the world. What a unique opportunity it is, and how exciting it is when we get a email from somebody in Australia, or from somebody in England, or somebody in Finland, or Norway, who are listening to our programs. And we realize, of course, we're extremely blessed to have this opportunity to share with our listeners programs like the one we have tonight. So if you would like to know more about our ministry, if you'd like a free copy of our newsletter, of course, the telephone number again, 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. We'll be glad to send you one, if you'd like a catalog, we'll be glad to send that to you as well. Again, the number 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, because America is certainly at war today. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this evening is Lucy Carter, and she comes from Samaritan First. Now, if you're out there across America listening to us, give us a call if you have a question or comment. I think this is such a wonderful, worthwhile ministry. I think it's just the sort of thing that Christianity is really all about, and that's helping people. So if you'd like to talk to Lucy, if you have a question or comment, our number, 464-8295, here in the Central Coast of California, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, if you're out across America, and 1-831-464-8295, if you want to call us from Norway or from Finland or from Europe or from Australia and New Zealand. But here we have a ministry that has a international outreach, and we really are pleased to have Lucy with us here this evening, telling us about the outreach and how lives are being touched really all across the world. Now, of course, you have your medical mission, and of course, I think that is really such a wonderful, wonderful way to touch people. Do you have any sort of an educational program in these countries where there really are no schools or no textbooks? Or, do you have any, you work with local churches? How does this set up?
Well, sometimes we do, if we identify the need for that. For example, in Afghanistan, we are looking at the possibility of educational programs, ways to help in education. That would be under special projects. For example, identifying the need for a water well in an area or a special need for education or development work. Yes, we do.
All right, fine. In fact, I don't know how many of you have read my newsletter. I think it was the April newsletter. When we actually talked about the our USAID program, where we were bringing in the textbooks that were actually encouraging the students to adopt the Muslim religion. Of course, most of them are Muslim anyway, but, you know, telling them about, and these are the textbooks we're handing out in Afghanistan at the present time, telling them, you know, how to add, you know, 2 bullets, 3 knives, and 4 landmines is how many weapons and how wonderful it is to worship Allah. Now, that's against the law, you know, to use American taxpayer money to push a religion. So that's all right. I mean, who is going to contradict that? I think that what we need is some religion over there that is not going to treat the fanatic form of Islam to these young, impressionable people over there. So this is certainly such a worthwhile project. In Afghanistan, do you know anybody who's been over there since the war? My understanding is it's just really almost totally chaotic there. I mean, you have your warlords back. At least under the Taliban, you had some sort of an organized form of society, and you didn't have thievery, and since apparently the breakdown now of the society by the warlords are all back again.
Well, you know, we have in my church a gentleman who teamed up with Samaritan's Purse. He was a city planner, and he is originally from Afghanistan, and he is there to, again, you know, to identify projects that are needed to be done in partnership with Samaritan's Purse. So he is there now. He'll be coming back in a couple of weeks.
Well, now, does he pay his own way, or is he helped, or how does something like that work?
Well, when he teamed up with our organization, then, you know, they paid for his expenses there. But he, you know, pays for the time that he is gone. So I believe that he decided to retire and to just do ministry work because he was really touched and felt the call to go to Afghanistan, back home, to do some good. He knows the language, he knows the culture, and so it was a wonderful gift to our organization.
Well, sure thing.
As a city planner, especially.
Right. And of course, the tragic trouble is for somebody who comes from our culture to go over there, we can't identify. We don't know how they think, how they, you know, how they feel about things. And of course, Afghanistan has been at war constantly for 22 years, you know, ever since 1980. And, you know, I'm sure that I just hope and pray that the peace will last for them. But here, as you say, here are people without hope. And so many of the Afghans have fled to other countries, to Iran or to into Pakistan or any place at all, just to get away from the constant fear of war and violence and rape and pestilence and disease, which has become has really become a way of life for them.
You know, Dr. Stan, our beliefs are not about a religion. It's about a relationship with God. That is so different.
Right.
Our God is a loving God. And we need to reflect that love and do things in such a way that people will be attracted to God, their creator. And if you have a capricious God, if you believe in a God that is just ready to, you know, to pounce on you, and you have to do all these works to try to reach him, there is no way to reach God by our own efforts. If people would only understand that God had to reach down to us. We have such a message that is powerful and so loving, and we are so full of it, and we try to find every which way to just get it across to people. It's not about us trying to spread our religion. It's about us trying to tell people that God is a loving God, wants to save them. He came to this world in the form of his Son, Jesus Christ, to save those people that he created and he wants back and to have a relationship with him. So we have such a powerful message. How could we hold back? How could we not spread it? We'll do it by any means we can because it's good. It's a good thing. In these warring nations that are without hope, we go, yes, you have to have that cold glass of water for the thirsty, that medicine for the dying. But how about hope for the future? How about joy, even the possibility of joy? That's all from God. Every good gift is from God, the Bible teaches us. And so in our ministry, as in many ministries that, you know, that you represent here, I'm sure, we just find every which way we can to tell people about God's love. And not to tell people about, this is our religion. It isn't that. It's because God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, for whosoever believes in him shall not perish, but have everlasting life. That is the message of life, hope, and love. And that's what Christ came to do. So we try to do it by every which way we can, including these little shoeboxes. What's right. in a shoebox? You know, just the opportunity to spread the message of love and hope.
And I think it's a wonderful, wonderful way to do it. Now, you mentioned, of course, that you actually had programs to build wells for people.
Yes, we actually will identify in certain regions a need for a well, and we'll build a well. It's not like we have a wells project. It's more like we have a special projects ministry, and we identify particular things according to where we are, like the refugee camp or water well or roofs. It might be about food. We're not, per se, a food ministry specializing in that. It's more like we go to a country, we see what the need is, and we see how we can fill a need that's not being filled or how we can partner with someone who's doing it and needs help.
And so then you work with other ministries, all sort of working together.
We sometimes
as best
do.
You can.
Mm-hmm.
And what about the United Nations? Do you work at all with the United Nations? Do you try to stay pretty independent of the United Nations? What is the relationship between your ministry and the United
Nations?
Well,
that's a very good question. First of all, we keep the most important thing on the top. So if we have to give up or not do what we believe we're called to do in representing Christ, then we will turn down money, turn down help, whatever we have to turn down in order to stay true to the calling of our ministry. Having said that, we'll work with the United Nations when that is the thing to do, when it's appropriate to do it, when we can do it and still not ignore our calling in representing Christ. In the case of the refugee camp in Kosovo, for example, the United Nations chose us among one or two organizations to build that refugee camp. We can't go out there and evangelize like in a crusade or anything like that. We wouldn't be able to do that. But they allowed us to do what we do within, you know, our belief system. And we were able to be represented as a Christian organization in doing that work. We also have had a lot to do with the U.S. government programs as we work around, for example, in Central America, some of the projects that we do there. We have been in partnership with USAID, and they have we have kept to their guidelines, and they have allowed us to do what we do. And yet, we have not had to ignore our calling,
which is primarily preaching the gospel of Jesus Christ.
Right. Now, we keep separate some aspects, for example, of our building projects. We simply will do it within budget and in the best way, and we have been chosen among. Among all the organizations that they could choose, we have been one of them they have chosen because they have seen how we do our work, how we build our homes, how we put on those roofs, whatever the work is. And so when we have aid from the government to do that, we perform. So that's not the evangelistic part of it at all. But we also then do other work aside from that while we're there.
Where do you get the people that train craftsmen to build roofs? That's something you really have to know what you're doing.
Yeah.
Do you use local people? Do you have the people who have just retired and do this as part of their personal ministry joining together with you? How does that work?
We use local people. First we start through the local Christian churches, evangelical churches, if we can. We begin there, and we use local people. We will either have volunteers, or we may have a program by which we hire. And that's what we do. We use local people, and to the degree we can fill the needs with them, we do. If we can't, then we'll put out a call to see if someone can go from here with a certain expertise. Like in the refugee camp, we needed certain types of engineers that were not locally available. So then if someone here knew about it and would volunteer their services, then they could stay there for a period of time helping us with their expertise.
Well, now, what about your doctors? Where do you get your doctors from? Do you have a regular staff of doctors? Are these all volunteer doctors?
These are volunteers. A doctor who is a believer can contact us and apply to serve on a short-term mission trip, let's say 2 months. They'll take 2 months sabbatical somewhere. Go there and help us. We'll identify for them a place where they will be. Their specialty will be needed, general practitioners or specialists, and then they are assigned a location, or maybe they have a preference, let's say, for a certain region of the world. So we match the doctors with the need, and for short-term missions work. And so they not only provide the medical help, but then as spiritual leads arise, they're equipped to handle that too and to share the hope. And that's the idea. We have hundreds of doctors who take these short-term mission trips. Some stay longer, are able to stay longer. But that same, well, if someone is interested in inquiring about our prescription for renewals conferences, every year we have one, either in North Carolina or here, you know, we can give you more information about how to, about recruiting doctors and medical help.
Okay, fine. And well, why don't you tell us a little bit about those conferences?
Okay, prescription for renewal normally would be in October. I don't know the specific dates for this year, but normally they're in October. We can take or accommodate about 500 doctors. They can have continuing credit by attending the workshops. It's about a three-day conference. And we talk about the different missions projects that we have around the world and teach, you know, the different methods that are used around the world to provide help in places where all the equipment is not there and it's very, very difficult, as you can imagine.
Oh, I can imagine. Yeah. You know, having practiced medicine here in the States, you know, you go into the operating room and everybody's there. The anesthesiologist has the patient asleep. The nurse has all the instruments you need. You have a sterile environment. You walk in, you do your job, you go out, write the orders, and they wheel the patient off to the recovery room. And really all you are is a technician. Then, of course, you follow the patient afterwards. But here in, you know, in the primitive areas you're talking about, I am sure that the sterility of the equipment, the anesthesia, every aspect of this is entirely different. You don't have the antibiotics that we would have here readily available to you, or the consultation. As an orthopedic surgeon, I was an orthopedic surgeon for many years, and we had a medical problem. I got an internist. We had an infectious problem. We had an infectious specialist. You know, it didn't matter what the problem was. You had a heart problem, you got a cardiologist. But when you're over there in these outlying areas, you've got to do it all yourself.
That's true. It's extremely challenging. But when a doctor feels called to the mission field, you know, then God equips those who are willing. And I do have a number that someone who might be listening would, you know, call to get more information about the World Medical Mission.
Well, if you have that number, why don't we just go ahead and put that up right now?
All right.
Go ahead.
Area code 828-262-1980. And they should ask for World Medical Mission Department and inquire about this. We need doctors to send around the world.
828-262-1980, and of course, Lucy didn't even look that up. She had that memorized.
Yes.
I'm sure that's something that really there is such a crying need for. And what an exciting thing it would be to be able to go into one of these missions and really help there for even for a matter of a few months. And I'll never forget when I first went to Africa, and we one of the first weekends that we were there, they packed us up and took us off to another one of the pantry stands. And the word had been put out that there were a couple of white doctors coming in, and the bachelor's stands were entirely black. Everybody there was black. And because we were looking for children who were going to need reconstructive work, or to be the reconstruction. And of course, they brought people, I think every sick person in the bachelor's stand came to see us. And they brought in 80-year-old women on a blankets, four people had carried them in, and we were supposed to do something, but you suddenly realize how anxious the people, how desperate the people were for the medical care.
Sure.
And it really was, in many respects, it was a challenging and rewarding and then even somewhat discouraging work, because I'll never forget the professor there. It was some of these children with horrible scoliotic curvature in the back, and he said, "We just can't take them. We can't take them. I wish we could, but you know, we can do so many operations. We weren't even supposed to be doing this. We were taking people into the Republic of South Africa for care. And, of course, it was going to be paid for by South African taxpayers. They said they'd take 20 operations. We could either do one patient with 20 operations or 20 people with one operation."
Oh.
And, you know, and it sort of breaks your heart to realize that there are sometimes, but you really can't do everything. You wish you could. But here, anything that can be done in these countries, I'm sure, is appreciated.
Well, you know, we have a board member, Dr. Mel Cheatham, who is also on the board with the Billy Graham Evangelistic Organization. And he wrote a book called Come Walk With Me. And it's about work that he has done in a mission hospital in Tenwick. It's Tenwick Hospital in Africa.
Okay, and what country is that?
In, I believe that was in Kenya.
In Kenya, right.
Yeah. And he also wrote Living a Life That Counts. They're wonderful books. And that same World Medical Mission number that I gave, if anyone's interested, these are inspiring books.
Well, is he an orthopedic surgeon?
He's a neurosurgeon.
A neurosurgeon. Well, the orthopedist and neurosurgeons always work very, very closely together.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
We were both involved with trying to restore the ability to walk and function. So anyway, of course, I really think it's a wonderful, wonderful thing that you do have the medical missions out there. But how then do you finance the facilities? Because you have to have, even if it's simply a tent, you have to have a nurse staff, you have to have an anesthesiologist, you have to have an autoclave, you have to have sterile instruments to work, no matter how primitive the situation is.
Strictly by donations. When there is a specific need, if I can send out a letter to the mailing list and say, okay, we want to do such and such work in this country where there's been an earthquake or whatever the situation has been, or there's a famine. If you feel, pray about this. If you feel led by the Lord to support us, send us support. And so we do everything by donations. And we identify a particular situation that we want to help, and then people will specify that that's where they want their money to go.
You know, Lucy, the average American really is a very generous person. I mean, I don't think there's probably any other country in the world that has been as generous and giving and really provided so much help to the rest of the world in all time as the people here in the United States. Do you find that to be true?
Yes, that is true. Very pleasing.
And it's really, I think we all look back to our heritage, and that's the heritage we need to maintain or regain or certainly, there's so many good people. I mean, we can talk about all the bad things going on in the world and all the bad things going on in our own country. But if I didn't believe that we had good and wonderful and worthwhile people here and a society that was worth preserving, I certainly wouldn't do what I do 5 hours every day.
Well, it's interesting to think about our history in that way, because there are people who are not necessarily believers of Christ, but they have great humanitarian hearts, and
right,
they're very giving. But our country was founded on Christian principles. So a lot of times, a lot of what we are and what we know and that we get culturally, we don't realize that at its very foundation is that love of Christ that was taught.
Amen.
And it permeates society, not always a person realizing where they got it from, and that the principle was taught by our Lord. And so I believe that's what's made our country great, even though many have turned their hearts away.
Amen to that. And I just think that it's so important that that we understand the foundations of our freedom and why America was different than other countries and try to reclaim our heritage. Well, now, of course, there's so many things that you're doing throughout the world. What about in communist China? Do you have any outreach there? Are you able to get in there at all?
We don't have, as far as Operation Christmas Child is concerned, we don't distribute shoeboxes there. It's not that we won't at some point. It's not the time yet to do it. But we do distribute in Mongolia and surrounding areas. But in the heartland of China, we haven't yet distributed shoeboxes. I think that's coming, though.
Nice.
We have done other work, but not the shoeboxes.
What sort of work would you be doing in China?
Bibles.
Bibles? Can you get them in? Oh, right.
Or
do you have to sort of bring them in a little planned?
I really don't know how.
All right, we won't pin you down.
Yeah,
with that,
I don't know how.
Sometimes,
and I don't even know if it's still being done. I know that we.
Okay, fine. So your ministry. What about in Malaysia? What about in the Indonesia, countries like that?
Oh, yes. We distribute shoeboxes there, and we do other work as well through doctors and through other relief efforts.
Certainly, I think that most people don't know that Indonesia is the largest Muslim country in the world.
Yes.
And people have no idea. I don't know how many people are there, but it's just unbelievable in that archipelago that they have. And the first of the Muslim religion is so prevalent in all of that Malay area, Singapore, Malaysia area, and of course, what a wonderful mission field that is. Now, do you actually distribute your boxes there?
Yes, we do. We distribute boxes there. It's a very, very dark place.
I'm sure that it is. Well, what do you do? You go through the local churches? Is this how you get them out? Do you have friends there, Christian friends? Or what are you? Because you have to have some place to bring all these boxes, too.
No, we send out a team. Sometimes we partner in a country with someone that has requested us to consider them for this because they've heard about it, you know, in another country. And then we study the matter and see if they're able to handle the project. Because it's one thing to want to use it as a tool. It's another to be able to logistically to handle it and to be able to distribute. It's a real partnership, and they must represent the goals and objectives and philosophy, if you will, of our ministry. And so other times we'll go out and find, you know, a partner because we want to go to a particular location. And once we see that they are able to handle it, receive X number of shoeboxes, maybe they can handle 10,000 boxes and maybe they can 300,000 because they have the facilities to keep them or they have connections to organizations that can help them distribute in some really remote locations. Once, you know, you can't get there through regular means, you might have to use mules to go up the mountains into remote locations. So a lot is involved, and we have people who go out there and make the way, the pathfinders, make the way, make the connections. And if they feel comfortable that it can, they do a lot of praying, very, very prayerful ministry. And then once we're there and we begin to receive the reports, we have an accountability program, and we want reports where these get distributed. What happens as a result of it, share some spiritual impact stories with us and all of that, then we know how to go on from there.
Well, you know, it's amazing, Lucia. I mean, you talk about a Christmas box, and of course most of us think, well, you know, we just get up and put these things in a box and give you $5, but then you stop and think of the transportation and getting it overseas, and then when you get it overseas, you know, getting it into the hands of somebody who can distribute it there, and putting it on the back of a mule or a donkey, and taking up the hills, what a wonderful and magnificent thing you're involved in. This must really be very exciting.
It's very exciting, and the logistics are really, really involved. It's a simple project that I'm in. It's Missions 101.
Right.
If you want to be involved in world evangelism or in world humanitarian effort, whatever, Missions 101. For us, you know, just getting 6 million of anything, even a clip around the world, if you can imagine, it can be a logistical nightmare. For us, it's a logistical blessing, of course, but very complicated.
Well, God bless you for what you do. Our guest this evening has been Lucy Carter, and of course, she's with Franklin Graham's Samaritan First Ministry. And if you'd like to get in touch with them, the number is 1-800-353-5949. That's 1-800-353-5949. Lucy, thank you so much for being with us, and I'm so pleased that you came over and we had a chance to meet you this evening.
Thank you, Dr. Stan. It's a pleasure for me to be here.
Good night.
Thank you.
God bless you.
God bless you.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we always get this part for you to remember to pray for my ministry, but pray for Franklin Graham's ministry, too. I think they're doing a great and wonderful job to help people throughout the world, and so until tomorrow at the same time, Dr. Stan, good night, and may the Lord be with you.
Evening, Friday evening, call the meeting.
Oh, no, we met earlier.
I'm trying to grow